when you race, you wake up, you know, a racer, you go to bed a racer, you leave 100%, and you put every thoughts of your life in the day is about racing, and you dream about it as well. So at night as well, we manage risk and we try to get away with it. And I do like to talk, especially about MotoGP. So I get quite passionate, and sometimes I just don't stop.
Favorite cheese, Silva?
Ooh, Stilton. Not even French.
Talking of cheeses, I don't know if you saw on the news last night, there was an explosion in a cheese factory. Debris everywhere.
Oh, sorry.
We'll cut that one out.
Hello there, and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, they'll tell you a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, today we are joined by an absolute legend. He's a very highly decorated international bike racer. He's been there and done it from GP, BSB, MotoGP. And now we love to say he's one of ours because he lives in the Midlands. Of course, he's a very proud Frenchman. You'll see him on TNT Sports along the side, the likes of Susie Perry, Hodgie, Gavin Emmett. He's a brilliant commentator and analyst, and we are very proud to have him with us this morning. It is the one and only Silvan Guintoli. Silvan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ewan. Thank you for that intro. I mean, it's a good job I made it to the computer before, because I couldn't pass the door now. My head would be too big. That was the best intro ever, mate. Thanks for that.
He tries his best, Silvan. I mean, the one and only Silvan Guintoli is an amazing opening to this, because it's the first time we've had a guest that rhymes with the phrase one and only. It's the little things, mate, that make me laugh and make me smile, just like we're going to laugh and smile a lot today. Let's get stuck into it. The love affair for motorcycling. We all love it. Where does yours come from?
Oh, it starts from a long time ago. So I used to go and ride with my dad. My dad was used to love bikes, and he worked a bit in the industry. He was a reporter for a French magazine. I was doing scooters and mopeds and stuff like that. So that's how I started. We used to have we used to get a few mopeds for new scooters for testing them and trying them for the magazine. Mm-hmm. So I was putting them to the test, and then I started racing when I was 12, scooters actually. And, it went from being a hobby to becoming my job pretty quickly, because I got to GP. I was only about 17, just happened really quickly. But it was all for fun from the very start. Mm-hmm. Once I got to GP, that was it. I absolutely loved it, and I just wanted to. I was just living, breathing, and thinking bikes. Yeah, all day long, and still do. So I love it.
We'll come on to your brilliant career shortly, but it looked to me, and it sounds to me like it was destiny. It was always going to be then. If your dad was heavily into motorbikes, and as you said, you were riding from such a young age, for you, I'm sure it became a dream. You never probably set out to think it would be your career, but did you have that ambition as a young boy when you were riding bikes? When did you realize you had some skill that you were good on two wheels? When did you know this?
So the career thing and it becoming a job was never on until I got to Grand Prix. Basically, it just feels it was all for fun. So we were going to the tracks, we were going practicing at weekends, and we're just having fun basically. And yeah, it just happened quickly, and it became a job before I actually thought, oh, actually I could be all right at this. The first year I competed, I won the championship, and then we thought, oh, okay, well, that's going well. And then the year after, mm-hmm. I sort of went up and went to 125 and won that. And then, after 3 or 4 years, I remember my dad telling me at the end of the year, look, son, this is too expensive. I can't, you know, we can't, this was getting really expensive, you know, doing the French mm-hmm. championship, and we were going to stop. And at that time, I sort of got lucky where there was every year there was the French Federation was doing they were doing this program called Équipe de France, the French team, and they were taking one young lad every year and helping you for a couple of years to make it to Grand Prix or a little bit further in your career. And so I got selected at the end of that year, where I was supposed to stop everything. And then the year after, I was in Grand Prix because they put me on a 250 GP bike, and it sort of clicked straight away. So yeah, it all happened really quickly without having it as a target, as in like it was never, oh, I want to be in GP, it was more of a it just happened. So yeah.
It's an amazing way to put it, Sylvain, and that kind of maybe that approach is what's helped you along the way, because I was going to ask you whether it was always a dream of yours, but given the practicalities of it, the finances of it, how much it costs, then it's something that you loved, something that felt right to do, and something that happened. I think in your professional lives, it can all sound a little bit straightforward, can't it? But undoubtedly, there's something in there that's an absolute passion of yours, isn't there?
Yeah, I love racing, and I like I like the way bikes makes you feel. So I like that, when I ride road bikes, even though I don't ride a lot on the road. And I definitely very much love that when I ride bikes on track. It's funny, this winter, I didn't ride for a long time. After the Boldo, so it was the last World Endurance race, which I still do this championship, the World Endurance Championship. And so that was at the end of September. And I didn't ride all winter, as in like almost nothing. And I got back on the bike for TNT in Austin on the, it's a road bike that we ride, a BMW N1000RR that we got all the cameras and it's like the onboard stuff. OG does that normally. But I was doing it in Austin. And anyway, I got on that bike and it was a track that I'd never ridden, Austin. And it was like, the explosion of adrenaline and how motorbikes makes you feel. I think this is something that is, for me, it's still the same as in when I was 6, 7 years old and just riding around the car parks. So I absolutely love it, and it's not wearing out. So it's a passion. I don't know. It must be chemical, And I suppose it happens quite a bit for loads of people. Motorbikes just makes you feel good. It's just what it is. So. But particularly with me, honestly, it just makes me feel so good. So yeah, I love it.
I think it's the as you might say in France, the ooh la la. There's something about motorbikes, isn't there? It's that.
Yeah.
It's the excitement, the adrenaline, the passion. It evokes so many memories, perhaps memories from when you were a child. But Austin's a tricky track as well. But what I'd love to know is, was there ever a backup plan? You said earlier you didn't think it was ever going to be a career until you got to GP. You thought, hang on, I'm pretty good at this. Maybe it could be my job. Was there a backup plan? Is there a hidden talent you have as a child? Perhaps, what did you want to be when you were growing up? What was your dream?
There was never a backup plan. I was doing all right at school, and the condition for me to ride bikes with my parents was that, because they're both teachers as well. And the condition for me to ride the bikes was to do well at school. So, but I enjoyed that as well, to be honest. I quite enjoyed school until I got to that French team and I was doing the French championship, the European championship, there's loads of traveling and stuff. And I was like suddenly getting out of my little village, traveling the world and just experiencing the world and racing bikes. And I was like, ooh, actually, maybe school is not so good. This is better. And this is much better. And so but it was never, I never felt like, I don't know how to put it. I never felt like the pressure of, I need to hang in there and I need to make this and I need to do that. I was just always riding to enjoy it. And obviously there's then when you become professional, there's like the performance. So you go a bit extreme with what you do. Because that's how that's what you need to do to succeed. But I enjoyed that bit as well later on. So I went through it's been a long time now since I started doing that. And I'd say I just went through phases where I sort of like sacrificed more at some times and tried different stuff with my training and with everything around the bikes. But the passion has always been there. So and it's always been the first sort of motto into what I was doing with the bikes.
Do you, given everything that you've said, Sylvain, thus far and your obvious passion for it, can you then pick out a career highlight? Is there only one? Are there several given how much riding you've done and where you've been and what you've seen?
Yeah, there's quite a few. There's quite a few. Obviously, when I won the World Superbike title in 2014, that was, you know, a big one in Qatar.
That's good to start with.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad one, that one. Well, and it was sort of intense because we at the time, for the title, it was versus Tom Sykes and the Kawasaki. And we sort of raced each other all year long. And it came down to the last race of the last round in Qatar at night. It was like, you know, 10 at night, floodlights, and whoever wins the race wins the championship. So it was
amazing.
It was sort of like a really good way to win it. Super exciting. And that is definitely the highlight. But there's been a few. Then when I transitioned to World Endurance as well, winning the world title in endurance and winning Le Mans and Boldor, these are races that you remember them very well because the emotions in endurance, in world endurance, once you've been racing for 24 hours nonstop, they are super strong. And there's motorbike racing is a team sport, but in endurance, there's even more of that element because, you know, the whole team like supports you and race with you for 24 hours. You got your teammate, you race with your teammates, as in like normally you're against them because your teammate is in sprint racing is your first opponent, isn't it? So in endurance, there's more of a group sort of effect, which I really enjoyed as well and still enjoying it now.
You can see from your face just the passion when you talk about riding bikes and whatever format of bike racing it is. It's definitely in your blood. You can tell you love it. Talk to us a little bit about the test riding stuff you do as well. I'm assuming many manufacturers just come to you and say, please test drive this bike, Chris. We want you to ride it. I mean, do you still get a buzz from testing? Obviously, it's not the same adrenaline as perhaps racing, but how much do you enjoy testing bikes?
Yeah, it's different. The testing is different. You do usually really long days and assess a lot of stuff. And I found that interesting because I've always had like a good feel with the bikes. So the bikes like sort of talks to me quite a bit. I know it sounds a bit weird, but it's like if she was talking to me. I feel what's going on quite well. So I enjoy doing that and sort of trying to help the teams with performance. So I started doing that with Suzuki back in 2017. For when the opportunity came up with MotoGP, with Davide Brivio and the Suzuki X-Star MotoGP team, and that was fantastic. I mean, I went to MotoGP. I did 2 years, 2007 and 2008. Then went to World Superbikes for many years, and that was like the opportunity to be back on a MotoGP bike, a current one, and a winning one as well. So it was a fantastic bike to ride. So I enjoyed doing that, for 5-6 years. And then the opportunity came up with BMW to work on the World Superbike project and the World Endurance project, which I still do now. And that's been fantastic as well and worked well as well. Obviously, with Toprak doing so well last few years. And the World Endurance team now, we're almost there. We've made a lot of progress and it's happening now. So the World Endurance project at BMW is going to win in the next couple of years, I would have thought.
You mentioned teams there, Sylvain, and you've been working with Hickey and the 810 team as well. Is that in kind of lieu of David Todd continuing his recovery from that crash in Daytona back in March?
Yeah, so this came up, and I'd been in the pipes for a little while, and so that's my third year with BMW, and there was like a double. So BMW wanted me to test the BSB bike to try and understand how, you know, potentially they can help the sort of specific BSB rules, which are different from World Superbikes. It's a different philosophy, and obviously you got no electronics, no wheelie control, no traction control, so the bike feels very different. And Peter Hakeman, so from the A10 racing team, he was keen as well to, you know, get a different eye on it, get a different take. You know, we get on well with Peter. We've known each other for many years, so he was curious to see what I would think of the bike and to see if I could help them as well. So it was a good opportunity. It was only 30 minutes down the road as well from me in Donington, which is perfect. So I popped in, rode 2 days, enjoyed it. I love Donington as well. It's a great motorcycle track, Donington. So it was good. That said, the BMW, sort of package with BSB, it's a bit of a tough one. So we're trying to find some ideas to make it a bit better. to try and improve it overall. But so that was a couple of days to as part of the global BMW racing project.
And Sylvain, just to talk on a technical term off what you said there about the kind of practicalities of testing bikes. You say about the bike talking to you. You even refer to it as a her, which I found absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
But then, given your abilities at that, how do you then? Because I presume you're quite mechanically minded and educated as well. Can you then tell the engineers A, B, and C needs to be done, or do you have to tell them in kind of a feel type way for them to interpret?
So it depends. Some things are obvious. So you are world and say, maybe we need to change this, or maybe we need to do that. But most of the time, I try and give like a feedback from a rider point of view. So obviously, in a project like this, everybody's got his job. So if you start by telling the electronics engineer how to type on his computer, it's maybe not the best thing to do. So it's a bit like if they tell you how to release the front brake or how to open the throttle, but you got to try. I think the important thing is to give the clearest and most understandable feedback that you can about how you feel on the bike, and then potentially you can suggest thing, because maybe you could say, 3 years ago we had a similar issue and it was the clutch that was not opening, or in the braking zone, or it was because we had too much engine brake, so why don't we try a little bit less and see how that goes. So the experience can come to play as well, but it's important to respect everybody's roles and jobs and specialities, as well. And I refer to the bike as a she, because in French, I know the French are weird, aren't they? What they do is that everything is a he or a she. So for example, a car in French, une voiture, so une is a she. Or une moto, she's a she as well, a motorbike.
She's a bike.
I'm just trying to find a helmet, arm casque. So a helmet is a he. French people.
I've been called a helmet many a time. Given the fact, Sylvain, that you are in so tune with the bike and you clearly respect everyone's role, I get that. But the fact that you are in so tune with how the bike works, how it feels, how it sounds and so forth, we've had Hickey and Toddy on here. Has road racing ever really appealed? The TT, for example, I mean, we speak to those races, and to me, they're a different breed. Huge respect to whatever form of racing you do. It's a different sport. Any temptation there for you to ever do the TT or to have done it?
Oh, there is temptation, yeah. I did. So some years back, it was about 10 years ago, I did a parade lap, and it was honestly one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And it was just a parade lap. We were on the closed roads, and remember it so vividly. There was Johnny Ray and Tom Sykes on a Kawasaki road bikes. I was riding for Honda at the time, so I was on a Fireblade SP road bike. And there was Charles Davis on a Ducati, and Milky was driving us. So it was it was our first lap, and I'd never been, didn't know the track at all. And so Milky is guiding the way on a road bike. He's sort of like warning us before the slow corners, giving us the bright lights just to, flashing us just to make sure we're not doing anything silly. But I didn't know at the time. So Johnny Ray lived in the Isle of Man and knew Milky. And he said, basically before starting, he said to him, as long as you see us in the mirrors, just give it some. And so we were at the back of that, just hanging for dear life. I mean, it was so dangerous to do that. But equally, when we got back, it was the best. I mean, the best thing, the best adrenaline rush you're gonna get. I mean, it was so dangerous, but so good. And at the time, I remember thinking, I think I could do it. I want to get stuck in. So I remember watching hours and hours of onboard and learning the track and everything. But then my wife stepped in and she was like, "Nah, that's not me, mate. No chance. No way."
Yeah, you were told.
But. Yeah, but it's one thing, wanting to do it or being attracted to it. And I think loads of people are, loads of riders might be, like I was at some point. But it's another thing to actually go out there and do it properly. Like I said, these guys, it's a different sport. It's a different sort of approach to risk as well, because that's what we do really. We manage risk and we try to get away with it. The thing is with road racing, it's a different equation. So these guys are amazing. Full respect to them, obviously. And I absolutely love watching it and going there. I'm really excited for the TT actually coming up soon. So yeah.
The dynamics of the different ways of riding and the different kind of championships is endlessly fascinating to us, Sylvain. When you look at MotoGP, and let's look at it from a particularly British perspective now. So since Cal Crutchlow 5 years ago, I mean, that's the last time we had a British rider in the MotoGP. We've had Hickey on, David Todd, as Ewan says, John McGuinness. We chatted to Carl Fogarty as well on our live episode about that. There is that dearth, isn't there, of British riders in it. So why can't there be somebody from here that competes with the likes of Spain and Italy in that particular competition? Can you see anything from your professional perspective that holds riders back or provides blockages for them?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that there is so many Spanish in Moto 3, Moto 2, Moto GP, eventually Moto GP or Italians, or it's not a mistake. I mean, it's
all luck or coincidence, is it? No,
absolutely not. It's because they have structures, you know, in place from really young age, and it's actually paying off now because they've had that for many, many years, growing up on with this in mind. You know, the target of being in Moto 3, Moto 2, and Moto GP. They've got a lot more. The pool is a lot bigger as well. So there's a lot more kids that are, you know, starting and practicing and starting to race, and that makes the level harder. But also, yeah, there's a larger number of people, of kids doing it. So they're going to find, you know, the cream is going to rise, and the talent eventually that they get at the top, they've got the numbers, and they've got loads of really very talented kids that race each other. So they make each other better from a really young age. So this is all trickling down. And then what you're left then with is some guys that keep turning up in Moto 3 are just unbelievable. You got, well, we've got another one this year, Kiles. I mean, what the hell? Mm-hmm. This kid is unbelievable. You've got all the ones in Moto 2. I know we're saying, there's going to be some change next year with, you know, new rookies arriving in MotoGP.
Yeah.
And guess what? They're all Spanish because they're so good. So you got Olgado. I mean, that's his second year in Moto 2, and he's unbelievable. You got David Alonso. I mean, what a talent. So he's been talked about as well. You even got a guy like Gonzalez. He's second in championship last year. He's destroying them again this year. And this guy has been overlooked. And it's like, well, they've got so many, you know, kids coming up. So it's hard to compete with and against. Yeah. And yeah, for the British, there's also that school of BSB that is great. And the level in BSB is amazing. And not many people realize that. The level in BSB is very, very good. Like, there's a really good sort of top 15 guys. They're very good. And the top 10 is really top class. But the problem is this sort of school of racing does not really transfer very well into the prototype racing. So... Mm. So it's a different way of riding, and then there's very little teams in Moto 3, Moto 2. We got MLAV, so Michael Laverty, or colleague at TNT Sports, he's got the Moto 3 team, and he's got teams as well in BSB, in the junior GPs, or it's called something else now. But he's got a lot going on there, trying to bring these British riders. But that's only started a few years ago, so we're gonna have to wait a bit for this to eventually pay off. So yeah, in France we're in the same case. You know, the France is the same. We've got Fabio Quartararo, a Joan Zarco, you know, brilliant. But then behind that, there is absolutely nobody. So yeah, it's a tough one, and it's a tough one to compete. It's who you compete against. These guys in Spain and Italy, they they are very good, and they, like I said, like I said, for all the reasons I've just explained, it's hard, really, really hard to make it.
Is it a cultural thing as well then, Sylvain? This sounds a bit of a lazy opinion, and get used to lazy opinions on air, mate. That culturally, Spain, Italy, France seem a bit more accepting of what riders are and what that is as a sport. It's still, even though as big as it is over here, there is an element of, in my mind at least, and absolutely feel free to correct me on this, that it's the perception of what motorcycling is. It's kind of in Britain to be pushed to the side slightly, whereas on the continent, it seems to be more kind of welcome with open arms. Is that too broad a take on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. Sometimes it's easy to assume that. But I think people that ride motorbikes, people like the, because we live in a small bubble, don't we? In England or in France or wherever. Yeah. People that are passionate about bikes or that like bikes, in the grand scheme, like the other people that don't know too much about bikes, they look at us, they think we're nuts. They think the general public, they think there's something wrong with us. And maybe there is, I don't know.
But a bit.
It is true. And sometimes if you don't step out of the bubble, sometimes it's weird because you almost think all this stuff is normal. I mean, it's probably not for most people. I don't think that's very, very related. I mean, you see in France, for example, motorcycle racing is more and more popular. So obviously Fabio Quartararo has helped a lot. Joan Zarco has helped a lot with their success. The Grand Prix, the French Grand Prix, is amazing. They do over 300,000 people. That's during the weekend. It's the biggest attendance of the championship. The Grand Prix is buzzing like from the Wednesday. Actually, it's amazing. Mm. But then again, they're doing very good with the TV as well. The TV figures. But it's still, it's still, there's still no. Like not a lot of French kids that are doing it, and also putting your kids really, really young on a bike, there's not many people that are going to do that, even if you're passionate about bikes. We've been on mini bikes and stuff with my kids, and I feel a bit weird about it, and that's my life, that's my job, that's everything.
Yeah, unless you're Scott Redding and you get your kid on a bike when he's still in nappies. But you talk about that MotoGP. Given what you've said about that MotoGP bubble, and we've established it's really quite hard to break into that, how easy is it then for a rider, or how hard was it to step away? We've spoken to James Toseland, and JT has lots of demons, having to quit racing because of injuries, and it's really hard. How hard was it for you to hang up the levers and say, do you know what? I'm a born racer, but enough is enough. I'm at the end of my career. Because it must be very hard to walk away from a sport which we've already established is very hard to get into.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm not fully retired yet. So I kept the World Endurance Championship, which is a lot less busy. There's four races in a year. So you've got Le Mans 24 hours, Spa 8 hours, which is very soon. It's in first weekend of June. We've got the Suzuka 8 hours, and then the Boldore, which is a 24-hour event at the Paul Ricard in September. So I've kept that, and I'm still racing in that, and I'm still competitive in that. So I absolutely love it. And I'll continue until I'm competitive. Everybody's story is different. In JT's case, he's and lots of other riders, when you have to retire for an injury before your time, when you're still in your prime, and that must be really tough, because it's like from one day to the next, your dream, your life, where you've worked, when you race, you wake up, a racer, you go to bed a racer, you leave 100%. And you put every thoughts of your life in the day is about racing, and you dream about it as well. So at night as well. so if that comes to a stop, because of an injury, it must be really, really hard to deal with, especially when it's a bad one that then hampers you on your normal day life. But so a lot of riders had to go through it, unfortunately. And if it's abrupt, like anything in life, if you got like abrupt changes of circumstances, I think it's probably harder to adapt for the human, the brain in general, when you have a big sort of shift like this. So yeah, I've been lucky. I mean, touch wood, I've had some very bad injury, but I've always sort of been able to fight back and came back. And now I'm doing a little bit of both. You see, I'm still racing, but then doing the TV job as well. So I'm like on both sides and I enjoy both equally. I love that. We've got a great team at TNT Sports with the MotoGP coverage. So it's not only a job, it is good fun. It's great. And we all work well together. So in a way, we're really, really lucky to be able to do that. Actually, with Roger, we're talking about it in Barcelona, just saying, you know, it's long days, but we were just saying to each other, you know, how lucky are we to do this? This is very special to be able to be there, you know, and enjoy the racing and enjoy this sort of a life that is sort of different from anything else out there. So yeah, loving it.
It's an amazing way that you put it, Sylvain, and the way you approach it. Let's just have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, you said there about the careers that you've had, the different kind of dynamics of it, and you asked the question about hanging up your leathers. But from the point of view of wearing said leathers just a few weeks ago in the London Marathon. So if you're listening to this and you don't realise just how unbelievable this man is on the podcast this week, you ran for charity. And please tell us about the charity and the backstory about it. Because I know it comes from an incredibly tragic place, mate. A marathon time of 3 hours, 47 minutes in full race leathers. I think even, and Ewan's obviously the expert on this particular podcast, but I mean, even in proper running gear, that would be a pretty amazing time, but in full race leathers. Please tell us about it, what it felt like, where it comes from, please, in memory of dear Luca, and just what it's done for you and just the good that it does for people in such horrible circumstances.
Yeah, so that was pretty special. For people that have not seen it, I did that to raise funds for a charity called PASIC, which is it's a charity that look after children and families that are affected by cancer. And so it's a charity that was really, really helpful to us. My son Luca was diagnosed with cancer in the summer 2024. He passed away last year, summer 2025. And so this charity was really, really helpful. With us, they looked after him really well and us as a family as well. So I wanted to give something back. I've been doing sort of fundraisings and stuff for them. And this one came like the idea came, so my two eldest daughters, Alicia and Leila, they're 20 and 18 years old. They wanted to run the marathon for charity. So I looked at it, trying to find some places for them. And one extra place came up from PASIC, and they were like, oh, do you know anybody that would like to do it? As in like, would you like to do it? So I was like, I don't know about that. Cause I don't run because I've had loads of knees and ankles injury, you know, over the years.
Right, yeah.
So I've always cycled. So I was thinking that might be a bit much. Anyway, talked about it. I thought, okay, I'll do it. And it was great to be able to do it with my girls as well. And then, you know, that idea came from, a guy on Instagram actually that sent me a message saying, why don't you do it in your leathers? I was like, the first thing was like, no, you can't do that. It's too long, you know, it'd be too hot. It'd be too tough. And then I thought, well, it might be not too bad. And also I thought it'd be a really good way to connect, you know, with people that follow me on social media, connect with our world basically, because it talks to you, doesn't it? If you've ever worn a pair of leathers, you know, you sort of like, you put your leathers on and then you go and grab your bike in the garage and you're already sweating because it's horrible, isn't it? So I thought, right, that would be, you know, some challenge. And it's true that, you know, on social media nowadays, there is a lot of people running marathons. You know, it comes up all the time and it's almost like it's not special anymore. It's actually a lot harder than it seems. But anyway, so that's where it was born. And so it did work really well. I did have to train quite a bit for it, and it was tough. Like, it was hot. I mean, it was so hot, and it was hot on the. I mean, the one day it's hot in London. It's going to be that day, isn't it? It was quite tough, but I'm so happy. I couldn't be happier. You know, there was a lot of funds raised. It was a fantastic day with the family and friends, and it was amazing. I couldn't be happier with it. It was worth the pain, put it that way. Yeah.
Well, firstly, huge condolences from all of us. You know, I've got three young children, and I can't imagine how tough it is for you. But a huge respect for what you did. I saw all the GP riders got together and did a lap and put the levels on. But what I'd love to know, having run 8 London marathons myself and struggled in little shorts and a vest, I mean, as you said, you alluded to how hot levers are, how uncomfortable they are, how much they chafe in the wrong areas. I mean, how did you train for this? I've just had visions of you running around Nuneaton or in the Midlands on a Wednesday afternoon wearing your levers and everyone going, look at that absolute lunatic. I mean, it's hard. Did you train a lot in the levers, or was it a case of you did it on the day and just hope for the best?
No, I didn't train a lot in the levers, actually. I did. like I said, even my neighbours were like, they're all thinking, you know, he's gone nuts, because I kept doing like tests in the little, we live in a little village and there's little lanes. And obviously, I wanted to try and find the best way or the less worst way of, you know, with the leathers, what to wear underneath, you know, where to apply the half a kilo of Vaseline, and and how to, you know, how to be able to finish it. So no, I did a little bit of quite a few test runs, and also, you know, putting the Camelback. Can I put a Camelback in? He's like, how much weight should I put? How much water? And energy, where do I put the gels, all this kind of stuff, you know, you've got to be prepared, basically. So I did that. And then I think it was in January, there was a half marathon that came up in Marloy Park. And we went there and did that. And I thought, I'll do it in the leathers, because it's only half. And so I can, and it was cold as well. So I thought, I'll do it to get feel, you know, for it. So it's the only long run that I did. To be honest, I never, before the marathon in leathers, I actually never ran more than half a marathon. I never did the more than half the distance, because it's just too, for me, it's too traumatic, like for the legs and the knees.
That's still a long way, though, a half marathon.
It's a long way.
I'd only ever did a 5K, but 13 and a half miles is still pretty far.
Yeah, but there's a big difference though. Like, half a marathon, you know, you just do it. Like, even if you're struggling, you do it, like, sort of, you go through it, and mentally you just push through it. It's fine. A full marathon, you know, when you're at like kilometer 30, you're super dehydrated, it's hot, and you know, everything is screaming in your body. The knees are destroyed. I don't know, I had so much chafing on the knees. Everything, it was like bleeding so bad, the knees. So that was not fun. Honestly, I had to really dig quite deep there.
You must have had some weird looks on the day as well. I mean, I know people do fancy dress, but sometimes it's very obvious. Someone's carrying a fridge, or they're dressed as a gorilla. They're clearly in fancy dress. But does someone just think, who's this idiot? I mean, you must have had a lot of people on the day ask you, mate, why the levers? Because it's so hot.
I mean, running around London looking like he's lost his bike.
Yeah. There's a lot of people shouting, "Oh, it's the motorbike guy!" And then loads of people were overtaking me, or I was overtaking. They all, like, loads of people had a nice, you know, word or stayed a little bit to have a quick chat. Some of them knew what I was doing. Some of them were like just a bit curious. It was honestly, it was such a great day, and I thought, you know, the vibe in the atmosphere in London that weekend was just so good. You know, the race, you'd think you get like quiet places, and that the actual event itself is amazing. I mean, it's literally 40Ks of shouting, screaming, people everywhere, music flat out. It was just, yeah. So in that respect, that sort of like helped, you know, with doing it. So it was that good. I've already signed up for next year, so I don't know what I'll do. Amazing. Maybe put a helmet on or something, I don't know.
Sylvain, would that be for Pasic again? And just give us a little a bit more information on that, because how do we find out about PASIC? And there's fundraising still to be had, isn't there? We can still donate, and if anyone's listening to this, they can still donate to that wonderful charity, can't they?
Yeah. Actually, the fundraiser from the marathon is still open. So if anybody wants to still, you know, support them, they can find the link. It's on my Instagram bio and Facebook as well, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's still open. And PASIC, they have a website as well. It's PASIC, PASIC, and they they're like a medium sized charity. So most of what is given there goes actually to organize events, to support families, and to support the children. Like I said, with us, they were really, really, really helpful, really good. Mm. So and it's the kind of, you know, it's the kind of thing that you, even if nothing has happened to you, like that, it's the kind of things that happen in life that you don't think it's going to happen to you ever. And people that do experience it do need help, and that's what they provide. So that's why I really wanted to do something special, and everybody, you know, a lot of people like helped as well. Like, I mean, TNT Sports and the guy at WBD, everybody was so good, you know, promoting the event. So they were in Jerez MotoGP while I was running in London, and they were sort of like following me live on the app. The London Marathon app, you can see, you know, where you are, and you can see the sort of like predicted time, because I was trying to beat, some idiot had done it before running in letters, and there was a Guinness World Record, so I was trying to beat that. So they were following me and putting the QR codes for the fundraising, and it's so helpful, so good. So again, the TNT Sports team, you know, just sticking together. We're like there's a really good sort of atmosphere there. I think you can tell as well, you know, when we are doing the weekends, we all get on really well. And we joke quite a bit, and we try and mix sort of like the professional side of things and also have a good time, because, you know, you only get one life, don't you? So
right, Silva. So right.
I've got to quickly ask you this. You say about the TNT family, and you clearly get on so well. Now, a little birdie, Hodgie, tells me that when Susie's about to throw to an advert or the end of a race or whatever it is, and you like to talk, you have a little code between you. Sylvain, stop talking. She gives you a little wink, does she? Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, I love it. That's your little cue. Please stop talking. Wink. Yeah, brilliant.
The wink gets better and bigger and bigger because obviously Susie's doing the hard work. She's doing the show. She's the one that has to sort of, you know, stop the program on time, send it back for the break advert, or send it whatever feature is next. And I do like to talk, especially about MotoGP. So I get quite passionate, and sometimes I just don't stop. So yeah, she does me that. So if it starts like this, like, you know, and that means like, right, so we need to wrap
like
that up.
A nervous twitch.
And then he goes like that. And then it proper goes like she's having a stroke. And that's when, you know, I'm just like, all right, that's it then. Yeah. So we do have a little codes. Mm. And it all works out in the end. She manages to control us most of the time anyway. So,
well, it does come across, Sylvain. And I always find the best sporting coverage is that one where you look at people that are having fun and are passionate and knowledgeable. And when you do watch that coverage, it's phenomenal, really. It really draws you in to what you think your opinions are and what your love of it is. And We it's been a lovely chat so far. Just thank you as well for talking to us about Luca and PASIC, and it words don't really do it justice about how incredibly tough that must be and is, and ebbs and flows. And I'm sure there's certain times that you and your family have to come together and really work through stuff. So we wish you all the love and all the luck with that moving forward. Let's push this part of the podcast into utterly frivolous territory, shall we? I've got a quick fire quiz for you if you fancy taking it on. You say you go to sleep a racer, you get up a racer, you're a born competitor. I think you'll enjoy this. Do you fancy it?
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, I think that's
and it would knacker things if you said no.
Yeah, and when you see us winking at you like this, that means your 60 seconds is up. So when you see this, stop talking.
So is this like really short answers, like one word
quick
answers,
quick fire,
fast?
So it's not about
perfect.
It's not the thing that I've yet to have described it to our wonderful guest before, and it rang a bell when we were doing another episode. Ewan, was me not telling our wonderful guests about it's just literally as quick as possible. It's not accuracy. It's just get through the questions as quickly as possible. There you go, mate. And we all know, listening to this, watching this, Sylvain Guintoli, that you are very fast, my friend. So if you're ready for this, I'm going to give you a minute and I'll tell Ewan to start. So are you ready?
Yeah.
Right, Ewan. 3, 2, 1, go.
Who was your motorcycling hero growing up?
Olivier Jacques.
What posters did you have on your bedroom wall?
Olivier Jacques.
Best bike you've ever ridden?
The Aprilia SV4 World Superbikes 2014.
Favorite cheese, Sylvain?
Ooh, Stilton. Not even French.
No, that's a bombshell.
You traitor, you traitor. The favorite short track you've ever ridden?
Phillip Island.
Least favorite circuit?
It's Balaton, but I've not even ridden it. It's a horrible place.
What is the best thing about living in the UK?
Oh, the pubs.
The worst thing?
The worst thing about the UK? Oh, I'm struggling there.
The weather.
Yeah, the weather. Thanks. Yeah.
It's not even time's up. You did well, Sylvain. You're about to cause an international incident with regards to whatever you said about England, but well done. We all don't like the weather, mate. It's fine. But the two parts about that as well, shockingly so, the Frenchman that loves pubs, I love you for that. Stilton, over all those amazing French cheeses you've got. Come on.
Stilton is good, though. It's just the perfect.
It's delicious.
Roquefort is nice, but it's too strong. It's sort of like, it's too much. Stilton,
Comté,
is the Roquefort.
I mean, there's so many. Don't get me started on French cheeses, mate.
Let me tot up.
Eight, very respectable, eight. Well, congratulations, Sylvain. Well done.
Talking of cheeses, I don't know if you saw on the news last night, there was an explosion in the cheese factory. Debris everywhere.
Oh, sorry.
We'll cut that one out. Right.
Sylvain, I'm so sorry. Sometimes I've just got to apologise for him.
But it's all right. You can edit it out. You can take that out.
I hope so. Right then, Sylvain, we have absolutely loved speaking to you, but unfortunately we are at time of the pod where it is the final question and we want to know your dream fantasy ride. So you can take your mind anywhere you want. We would love to know, where would this dream ride be? On what bike would you be riding? And would there be a soundtrack? Would you be having any music or just the music of nature? Where would you go and what would you ride?
Oh, I'd go to Phillip Island, not in October when we go to MotoGP. I'll go in February, like when we go with World Superbikes, where the weather is much kinder. I'll be riding the Aprilia MotoGP bike, the current one. And I would definitely have, I mean, it sounds good, that bike, but I will have some music as well. I'll have a bit of a Thunderstruck.
Yeah.
By AC/DC.
Oh, yeah. AC/DC. Nice. Yeah, man.
Nice.
Yes. That sounds nice.
You are a born racer. And the reason why I say that, we know that, but most people's idyllic ride is like, I don't know, Route 66 or in the Swiss Alps, like on a comfortable bike, relaxing. You are like, I'm on it. Yeah, love it.
I mean, it's nice to cruise around as well, but if you're going to, you know, you asked me the what I would do, like if I could put it all together, that's what I would do. That would be that. I'm just thinking about it now. I can't get it out of my head.
Sylvain, this has just been an absolute pleasure, mate. The your approach to everything that's come your way is just, we use the term inspirational on this podcast because a lot of inspiring people do give us 45 minutes of the time, and you've really done that, mate. It's been a real pleasure chatting and listening to your story.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been nice to speak to you guys. We've not really met before as well, so I've heard I've watched the podcast a couple of times. I've watched the Foggy one and watched another one as well, and I thought it was pretty good. So it's been yeah, it's been a pleasure to have a chat, guys. And yeah, hopefully we can do it again, maybe later on in the year.
Genuinely.
On next year. Some catching up.
It has been our pleasure, genuinely. And you're lucky, because I did chat to Hodgie before we came on air, and he did ask me to talk about your black and gold Speedos that you wear everywhere. But we've run out of time, so luckily we won't be talking about that. But
I've got them on.
Honestly. You don't have to show us. Honestly, like Prutt said, thanks for coming on, because not only are you clearly a brilliant motorcycle racer, we know that, but on top of all of that, you are a very decent man, and we can tell that, and you're a kind, funny, good person, and it has been honestly a pleasure to have you on. So thank you for spending the time to be with us. It's one we're going to remember for a long time.
All right, guys, well, thank you very much, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, sadly, that's about it for this week's Full Chat, powered by Bikeshaw, of course. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance, and so much more.
As we've said, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you very much to today's special guest, the brilliant Silvan Gintoli. Brilliant.
An absolute pleasure to chat today, and get yourself over to the Passic website as well to donate, given that fact that the man himself ran in full leathers and got under 4 hours. That blows my mind. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, thank you very much to everyone who's tuned in. If you want to hear more brilliance like we've had today, then make sure you join us next time. Until then, goodbye.